Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel of human rights defenders. Briefly, just let me set the context for understanding the courage and the commitment of our speakers who are being honored this year by Human Rights Watch, who is doing this program in association with us today. First, we have Bo Ji, who, as a former political prisoner and co-founder of the Assistance Association of Political Prisoners, AAPP, works nonstop to secure the release of Burmese people who've been jailed for their political independence and activism. Some 1,920 people remain imprisoned in Burma, where they endure abysmal treatment by the ruling military junta for opposing its horrific abuses. Upon his release from prison, Bo Ji fled to Burma's border with Thailand, where he helped found AAPP. The organization works on behalf of current and former political prisoners and their families, provides them with financial support and medical care, monitors prison conditions, and advocates internationally for the prisoners' release. Next, we will present Umida Niyazova, who is an independent journalist and human rights activist from Tashkent, Uzbekistan. She previously worked for the Tashkent Representative Office of Human Rights Watch and Freedom House. Umida has worked to expose the Uzbek government's campaign to silence human rights defenders. She has, at great personal sacrifice and risk, advocated on behalf of her fellow citizens and compelled the international community to scrutinize the Uzbek government's deplorable human rights record. We will also hear from Dave Matheson and Allison Gill, who will give an introduction to our speakers, our human rights activists, Bo Ji and Umida Niyazova. Please welcome them.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much for making time to come and see us today. Unfortunately, the message that we've been giving out to people about the human rights situation in Burma in our tour through North America in the past couple of weeks has been increasingly bleak. I'm sure everyone remembers the amazing spectacle of thousands of Buddhist monks marching through the streets of Rangoon in Burma last September, and the violence that was used to crush that spontaneous movement in protest against military rule, which has been imposed on Burma since 1962. In the past year, Human Rights Watch and Bo Ji's organization, the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, believes that more than 1,000 people were arrested. We know that thousands were actually arrested and many released soon after the demonstrations. But 1,000 key political activists, monks, nuns, labor activists, journalists, and other people who resisted military rule remained in prison for the past year. About 3 weeks ago, the military government started to actually sentence a lot of these activists. And this is where we've seen the true colors of this military regime come through. Some of the activists are facing jail terms of 150 years of 22 charges. Some of these charges include unlawful association and violations of the Communications Act, which basically means using a mobile phone to call your friends to come and peacefully march down the street. Many of these trials have been conducted in secret inside prisons or in closed proceedings in courts. And to add a new twist to their violent authoritarian methodology, the military government has actually been sentencing lawyers of some of the defendants. So in very basic terms, the defendants have instructed their lawyers to withdraw representation because the proceedings were so grossly unfair. The lawyers then tried to tell the judge that this was the case, and the judge sentenced them to 6 months jail for contempt of court. So two lawyers sentenced to 6 months, and two other lawyers sentenced to 4 months imprisonment. Some of the other sentences that have been handed down include an 80-year-old nun sentenced to 4 years hard labour after she was arrested at a monastery school last September in Rangoon. Other monks who were arrested in nighttime raids, in which we believe dozens of monks were brutally beaten and several actually murdered during these raids, the abbot of one of these monasteries received 4 years hard labour. Some of the labour activists that have worked tirelessly to expose the extent of forced labour within the country include Masu Sunwe, who received 12 and a half years. And she was arrested last November for trying to reach the United Nations Special Rapporteur for the Situation of Human Rights in Burma. And this was after 2 months where she was underground in hiding, and she made it all the way to his hotel before being picked up by the special police. They also include a young blogger, internet blogger, who's 28 years old. He received 20 years for posting things on the internet. The reason we believe that this is happening is because the State Peace and Development Council has planned elections for 2010. And I'm not sure if anyone here remembers that in the midst of the horrors of Cyclone Nargis, which struck Lower Burma in May of this year, in which about 150,000 people were killed because of that cyclone, just over a week after the cyclone hit, the military regime conducted a referendum on their new constitution. And this culminated something like 13 years of writing a new constitution in which people were excluded from the process and which will basically ensure future military rule through a civilian parliament. And the referendum was to endorse this new constitution. The regime claimed that 98% of the voting population actually turned out and voted, which was absurd by any measure. And 92% of them actually endorsed the new constitution. And although I have met people from Burma who said that they voted yes, they said it was basically vote yes or it was a death sentence or they'd lose their homes or some other drastic action. So the reason why all these people inside Burma are being sentenced is because this is the military regime's preparations for the 2010 elections. And these people being sentenced are the ones that could form political parties, who could resist, who could write articles, who could post things on the internet, or in the case of monks and nuns, actually provide solace to a population that has been brutally battered down, deprived of its basic rights, and deprived of basic living standards for the past 20 years, especially. Bolji is a friend of mine who is a former political prisoner, and since his release from prison more than 10 years ago, runs an organization in collaboration with many of his colleagues who are former political prisoners that documents how many political prisoners there are in just over 40 jails throughout the country. Some of them so terrible that a monk that Human Rights Watch interviewed just a month ago, who'd been arrested last September, he'd been dumped in a labor camp near the Indian border and realized that if he stayed there, he would be dead. That they were basically working prisoners to death. And prisoners inside Burmese prisons, especially the labour camps, are either worked to death or taken to the front line to fight in the civil war to carry supplies for the military and then basically killed when they're no longer useful. So this monk actually fled and got into India, where we managed to speak to him on the phone and he told us about his experience. But Bolji's organisation documents conditions within some of these prisons and camps and how many prisoners there are. And one of the most remarkable things I think his organisation does is provide support to the families of political prisoners who are often forgotten in this political mess inside Burma, is how much the families of political prisoners continue to suffer. And it's emblematic, I think, of just the everyday fear that many people inside Burma feel about stepping out of line and challenging the authorities. And so Bolji's organisation is, I think, one of the most credible and accurate and outstanding organisations working on Burma today. So I'd like to introduce you to him.
Thank you very much for allowing me to speak. Also, thank you very much for the kind introduction. Your introduction is very good. Also, as David mentioned, I spent in prison for 7 years and 3 months, just very short. So because compared to my colleagues, they still remain in prison since 1989, 1990 to until now. Some of them, they already been in prison for nearly 20 years. Even though I had a separate discussion with Burmese military region when I was inside Burma, I'm trying to advocate their release them directly because, you know, they were arrested. They did just only non-violent. Some of my friends, they were accused. They were doing bomb explosion or terrorist act. Those accusations are not true. Also, I explained the military intelligence in Burma. You arrested wrongfully. Also, therefore, I want them to release. But they said no. Actually, they want to save their face, but they don't care for the people's life. When they were arrested, they were students like me. In 1988, also, I was a university student as final year. You know, I don't want to go to prison, but in my society, there is no basic freedom rights. There is no union. We cannot set up student union because our student union was dynamited by the regime, by the army in 1962, before I was born. But I had a student spirit. Because I want to get the truth. I want to get freedom. But in our time, in my time, at first I didn't involve in any students' demonstration. Other students were doing demonstration. I sat in the examination room. But I look at, also I heard they are shouting, one democracy or want to get rid of one authoritarian system. I heard. Then at the time, I was thinking. I was sitting in the examination room, what for? What I can get from, even though I passed my exam. So finally, also I like the through the table, and then just getting attention from other students. Then I started preaching them. The reason why we did, sitting in the examination room. We cannot get anything. Therefore, we should join to the demonstration. That was on March 14, 1988. But since that time, I have already known I will be in prison sooner or later. Because in Burma, if you do the demonstration, if you ask for your freedom, that is enemy of the state. Therefore, I prepared my mind. If I was arrested, that was very lucky. But I had to prepare how to survive in prison. Other than I started reading and also asked some other experienced people. In Burma, it's really easy to find former political prisoners. So because many students before me, also they did a lot of demonstration asking for students' rights, other basic rights, but they didn't get it. What they received was torture, killing, and then flee into the country. Also, in my time, also I need to continue. Then, finally, I was arrested. I did a demonstration. I led one demonstration, asking for the release of students' detainees, then to recognize our student union as legal organization. That was in 1990. So the judiciary is, at that time, military court, not the civilian court. Military officer asked me one question. Didn't commit a crime. I'm replying that absolutely no. He replied that 3 years imprisonment would hurt labor. That's how finished the trial. Also, before the trial, I was in the interrogation for 8 days. During 8 days, for the first 36 hours, I was not allowed to drink and eat. Then I received just only punishment. Also, different kinds of punishment and beating. That's all I received. But just only 8 days, I could survive. Then I was released from prison 3 years later. Then I was rearrested again in 1994. At that time, they really wanted me to join with them to be an informer for them. I said, I will do it, but they must agree just only 2 points. One is to release all political prisoners. Second is to enter dialogue with Aung San Suu Kyi, our leader who is there under house arrest. Although they said no, when they said no, I said no, I could not deal with you. At that time, they said 3 years imprisonment is not enough for me. I could not take a lesson from 3 years imprisonment. Although I said yes, please open the door. And then they opened the door for the custody and I walked down and also I could sleep very well because no need to worry for the arrest because I am under arrest. You know, that's the way I received another 5 years. During 5 years, also, mostly, I was in the tiny cell, 23 hours and 40 minutes. I need to stay in the room, just only 20 minutes. I had to go outside. But I could study my English lesson when I was in prison, even though I was not allowed to read or write or study. But they arrested not only students, but also professors and other teachers. That is good. There is balance. You know, therefore, I could study. So I really thank to my teacher. Now he is inside Burma. He is not arrested again because now he is too old. So around over 70, and his health is not good. So that's the way. But 1 year later, I was released from prison in 1998, October. Now almost 10 years, I was released from prison. But I had no intention to flee from the country. I stayed inside Burma. I did as a private teacher, but I could not do freely. They disliked me what I did as a private teacher. At that time, my curriculum is Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That is my curriculum for the students. Because I felt that people should know, new generation should know human rights. Now, military regime, they don't do any standard education for the students. Also, human rights, Universal Declaration of Human Rights is just for people work. They don't teach the new generation. They don't teach the students. So therefore, on behalf of them, I did it. Because if new generation knew, we can promote human rights. We can protect human rights. If they don't know, how do we promote and protect? Now, in Burma, some of my colleagues, they know that they will be arrested, but they are doing human rights promote and protect. They set up themselves, organization called Human Rights Defenders and Promoters Group. Really incredible. Now they were in prison. They know that they gave a training, they gave a washout among the people, but military regime accused them as terrorists. And then they accuse that group take money from me. You know, that is punishment. Also, I think they will be given more than 20 years. Might be death penalty, or if you do the solo protection, you'll be given life imprisonment. You know, I was also surprised. Doing a solo protection means nothing. He is showing his desire, but they give life imprisonment. Then he was transferred to remote area. Now he is suffering. Now he is almost late 70. Since 1988, he was arrested. I stayed together with him in prison for two years. Then I was released. After that, he was released. Then he was arrested again in 1996. Oh, also, I was arrested again 2 years before. I met again in prison. We stayed together. He memorized all the Oxford Dictionary. He is my walking dictionary. You know, when I was in prison, whenever I want to know the words, so I ask. So 2.5 years, he memorized all the Oxford Dictionary in prison. It's incredible. But now he is in prison again. I need to advocate for his release. Also, I need to help his family. Also in Burma, there are 2,100 political prisoners in Burma. Also, most of them need a lot of help from us. So I really want to request your support will be really helpful and more encouraged and then really useful for those who are still fighting against the injustice. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm Allison Gill. I'm the director of the Moscow Office of Human Rights Watch, and I'm a former researcher on Uzbekistan for Human Rights Watch. And thank you to the Commonwealth Club for hosting us today, and I'm really excited to see so much interest in the countries that we work on. I'm very proud today to introduce you to my friend and colleague, Umida Niyazova, who is a human rights defender and journalist from Uzbekistan. But before I give you a little bit of background on Umida, I'll give you a little bit of context on Uzbekistan because it's not a country that many people in the U.S. know very much about. Uzbekistan, as I'm sure you do know, though, is a former Soviet republic, and it is one of the most repressive countries to emerge from the former Soviet Union. To give you a picture of the context in which Umida works, I'll sort of tick off some of the most difficult and entrenched human rights problems that are in Uzbekistan. Torture is widespread and systematic. The judicial system is entirely corrupt and controlled by the government. So prisoners are incredibly vulnerable to abuse and they have no due process or other fair trial rights. There are no free media in Uzbekistan. All media are state controlled or loyal to the state. The internet is also very tightly controlled so that there are no independent sources of information about Uzbekistan accessible from within the country. Uzbekistan is a very densely populated country. Some 30 million people live in Uzbekistan in a territory slightly bigger than Germany. It's also a very poor country. It's a major exporter of cotton. It's the second largest exporter of cotton in the world. But the growing of cotton and the harvesting of cotton is a system built entirely on abuse and relies heavily on forced labor and child labor. There are no opposition political parties in Uzbekistan. Dissent is considered dangerous and most, if not all, forms of peaceful dissent are illegal. There is a widespread crackdown on religious freedom in Uzbekistan. Although most of the population is Muslim and the government encourages a certain kind of practice of Islam, anybody who practices the religion outside of very tight government restrictions is considered dangerous or potentially extremist and is often subject to persecution and prosecution. There are some 6,000 people in Uzbek prisons prosecuted for their peaceful, nonviolent religious beliefs and practices. In 2005, there was a massive demonstration in Uzbekistan, in Andijan, a city in the Fergana Valley. There had been a small armed attack on a prison in Andijan to free a group of local businessmen who were very who had a lot of popular support in the community. This small armed group then took over a local government building called the Hakimiyat. But during the course of the day, because of the commotion caused by the armed attack, many thousands of peaceful people ended up coming to the main square to hear what was going on. Over the course of the day, this was May 12th to May 13th, 2005, some 10,000 people took to the main square in Andijan, people who had nothing to do with the armed incursion, people who were just there to demonstrate and to discuss their social grievances. People started talking about poverty. They started talking about other social problems and were calling on President Karimov to come and listen to them. Instead of listening, to the people that gathered. The government sent in the military and shot at peaceful protesters, killing hundreds of people. It was the largest demonstration ever in Uzbekistan's history, and the government responded with heavy fire. Killed hundreds of people in the square and also shot at a column of people attempting to flee the square. After this massacre in Andijan, the country has only grown much more closed, much more difficult to work in, and much more restrictive. Since the Andijan massacre, the government has waged an incredibly fierce crackdown on anybody who calls for accountability for what happened in Andijan, or anybody who tries to voice any kind of dissent or government criticism. So this is a little bit of a picture of Uzbekistan today, and this is the context in which Umida and other colleagues live and work. Umida is an independent journalist who has written about a variety of human rights issues in Uzbekistan and has done research on most of the major human rights problems in Uzbekistan, from religious persecution to torture to political participation to child labor. She is very important figure in the Uzbek human rights community because she has dedicated a lot of time to understanding the NGOs and to dedicating a lot of her work to capacity building, information security, and other things necessary to grow a real civil society in Uzbekistan. So Human Rights Watch is very proud to have Umida as a friend and colleague, and I'll turn the floor to her.
Thank you very much for your interesting. Alison, I think, told about the Uzbekistan. It's a very clear picture that Uzbekistan now is one of the most repressive and closed country in the world. And just for the last 2 months, two of my colleagues and my friends, they were sentenced to 10 years in prison each for fabricating a case on selling drugs and extortion. And it was very, very clear fabricated cases. And even, for example, 58-year-old journalist Solijon Abdurakhmanov, who used to work for Radio Voice of America, the drug was found in his car, and the car was stopped on the street, and this car before was at the repair shop, and the key was in the mechanic, and his lawyer says that during the trial, nobody even asked him where he get these drugs and who he was going to sell it. I used to work for different human rights organizations for the last 8 years and did a lot of research on child labor, religious extremism, torture, and I observed many trials and against political activists, human rights defenders, and independent journalists. Last year, on January, I was arrested, and National Security Service confiscated my computer, and they made the expertise, which says that the materials in my computer, they have contents of religious extremism propaganda, and for against public security. And in the expertise, it says that the material with religious extremist propaganda is the Human Rights Watch report on Andijan massacre. And there was many, what was in my computer? It was my human rights and journalist materials. There was many interviews with children, teachers, parents, children who are forced to pick cotton. As Alison told, Uzbekistan is the second big exporter of cotton in the world, but government use child labor and forced labor to harvest cotton. Every year, about 2 million children, since September to November, they're forced to pick cotton. The norm is 20 kilo a day, and we are receiving the information just 1 month ago that 70 years old student, she hung up herself in the cotton field, and her students told my colleague, human rights activist, that he could not received any more critics because he could not take these 20 kilo norms a day. I was arrested and I was in jail in this cell, 23, 20. Also, I have about 15, 20 minutes outside, go outside. In May, there was a trial, only 1.5 day trial. And I was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And during the trial, I tried to protect myself, and I tried to tell about the constitution. We have a very good constitution, which says that Uzbekistan is a democratic, open country, and everyone has a right of freedom of expression, but my words was just ignored. In 1 week, on the 7th of May, there was an appeal trial, and I was released. And I have to thanks to Human Rights Watch, because my colleagues, Human Rights Watch, they mobilized all their forces, and there was a big pressure on Uzbek government, and European Union made a statement, and U.S. State Department also made a statement saying that calling on Uzbek government to release me. Now I moved to Berlin 2 months ago, because I have a fellowship program at Human Rights Watch, but Berlin, Germany, is a very important place for Uzbekistan. After Andijan massacre in 2005, only Germany has kept high-level relationships with Uzbek government. Germany has a military base in Uzbekistan, and they have some economic relations. So I'm meeting with German politicians, with the members of green opposition parties and foreign offices, trying to make them to release my colleagues, human rights defenders. Besides this very tight control and repressions in Uzbekistan, there are people, human rights activists, very brave, independent journalists, who informed international community what's going on in the country. Even they could be or less arrest. They used nobody, no one in Uzbekistan used his own name in his materials. All of them used pseudonyms. I think that this is very important to continue human rights work, because Uzbekistan the people of Uzbekistan is very poor, but Uzbekistan is a rich country. We have cotton, gold, and gas. And what we need freedom. We need freedom of expression. We need political opposition. And that's why I'm continuing my work. Thank you.
Our thanks to Bo Ji, co-founder of the Assistance Association of Political Prisoners, and Umida Niyazova, journalist, for their comments here today. I am Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum, and I'm moderating today's audience question period. I'm sure we'll have some questions. We have the mic right there if someone would like to stand and ask our first question. We'd also like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Meet the Human Rights Activist, Bo Ji of Burma and Umida Niyazova of Uzbekistan. Well, I'll begin the first question with Bo Ji. While you were in prison, what reprisals were happening towards your family, if any?
For my family?
Sorry. How was your family affected?
They can stay peacefully, but they are under surveillance. Also, they are very busy. They have to use a lot of money for me because my family live in capital of Burma, in Rangoon. At first, I was placed in a prison located in Rangoon. At the time, family could visit me regularly, and also they no need to use for much money. But intentionally, I was transferred to the remote area, 500 miles away from my family. At the time, they economically also they face a lot of difficulties. Also, they cannot do other big business. So, because in Burma, if you want to do big business, you have to one of your family involved in politics. The rest of the family they cannot do the big business. So that is the really effective for the whole family.
And Umida, in Uzbekistan, I guess I would ask the same question. Were there reprisals against your family still, even now that you're living in Berlin?
Yeah, well, all my family, my mother, brother, and sister, they are in Uzbekistan, they are in Tashkent. And this is the danger of the family. This is the most concern, I think, for every human rights activist who are living in such a repression country. But so far, there were not pressure on them. But I'm calling them every day, and this is the. The most concerned things. Yeah.
And this is a question, I guess, that's open to anyone here on the panel. Can you sort of help our audience understand what the change in government now that for the United States going forward after January 20th of this year will mean in terms of diplomatic relationships with the U.S., with Burma, or Myanmar, and also with Uzbekistan and the rest of the Central Asian republics? So I guess I'd like to hear from whoever wants to answer all those.
I'll start off in regards to Uzbekistan. The U.S. over the past several years has had different levels of involvement and engagement in Uzbekistan. After September 11th, the U.S. government opened a military base in southern Uzbekistan to help wage the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. war in Afghanistan. And this, the military base and the agreement around the use of the base provided, had pluses and minuses for the human rights situation. It provided a tool for engaging with the government on human rights because there was such a deep relationship. The bilateral agreement that was signed between the U.S. and Uzbekistan had in it some provisions for the functioning of civil society, for the protection of human rights, and each year the U.S. State Department was required to certify whether or not Uzbekistan was making good on its human rights commitments. I mean, it's a complicated picture. The bilateral agreement and the use of the base did provide some engagement, but they also provided incentive for the U.S. government to make things sound better than they were. We often saw during that period, like the Department of Defense undermining the State Department's speaking out on human rights issues because it was the country was strategically important. After the U.S. criticism around the Andijan massacre, the U.S. was kicked out of Uzbekistan. The base was kicked out, and the engagement has dropped off to some degree. And we don't have all of those same kind of tools for leverage. President-elect Obama has talked about stepping up the war in Afghanistan, and that, and perhaps we'll see Uzbekistan, return to the discussion as a country of strategic importance for the U.S. We'll see. There have been rumors over the past year or so that the U.S. has renewed interest in Uzbekistan for a base. We'll see with the stepping up of the war in Afghanistan if that happens. But that would be the issue around which we'd see, I think, deepening U.S. engagement.
Thank you.
Omi, did you want to add to that?
Okay. Hi. I have a question for David. Do Burmese people think about our involvement in their country? And also, what do they think about Obama?
Well, I think Boji should really answer most of that. The one thing that I would add to your question, and also following on from Allison's point, is that paradoxically, the outgoing administration was actually very good on Burma. The Bush administration did have a very strong principled stand against military rule. They imposed sanctions. And especially the First Lady, Laura Bush, was genuinely passionate about the cause of Burma and did great work, I think. So for an incoming Obama administration on Burma, we would say we would like to continue a lot of the policies of the previous administration. But one thing that we would say, and this is a challenge, I think, for the administration as a whole, is that there needs to be more consensus building and more U.S. leadership in Asia about Burma. And that's one thing that a new administration could do is actually say to the countries bordering Burma, all of whom are the ones that are really propping up military rule through arms sales and through natural resource extraction. So India, China, and the countries of Southeast Asia really are the ones, keeping the Burmese military in place. And I think the U.S. could do a great service to Burma if it took diplomatic leadership in creating a more broad-based consensus in engaging with and pressuring the military regime. But as to the Burmese reaction, the social reaction to the Obama administration, I think Boji should really answer that.
Also, fortunately, I met him in person in 2005. Also, John McCain, also I met also President Bush, also I met him very recently in August when he visited Thailand. Yeah. Also, all of them are really good. They really want to do something for Burma, but the problem is United States approach to Burma is more ideological, democracy than human rights, not strategically than not other things. Also, another difference is China, India, and ASEAN countries, their approach to Burma is more business interest and strategic point. So at the time, lady, we need also I really expect that President-elect Obama will do more on Burma, especially we want coordinated effort. Now policy gap between among the superpower countries paved the way to the military regime to survive. So we need to small a space for them. At the time, lady, we can do something for change in Burma. Otherwise, it will be really difficult.
Thank you very much.
While we're waiting for the next questioner, Umida, did you want to talk a little bit about your hopes with the incoming Obama administration? as it relates to Uzbekistan.
Yeah, I have to say that the Western government has influence on what's happening in Uzbekistan, because historically we Uzbekistan were occupied by Russia, and President Karimov, he wants to have better relationships with Western, and he afraid on rely on Russia, even if President the former President Putin and now the President Medvedev, if even they support President Karimov and never criticize for human rights abuses, and nevertheless Karimov wants a good relationship and with Western. And I think that the U.S. government should be more critical, and they should ask and press Uzbek government to do the very concrete things to show a human to improve human rights situation in Uzbekistan.
Thank you.
Hi. My question emerges from a historical perspective from the 19th century of the Crimea, the role of the Crimea and Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, and other countries in that area where there was French, German, Russian, and American interest. So with that long lineage of financial interest in your area, how can you be sure that the human rights plank of the United States isn't appropriated and put to the service of other material global geopolitical economic objectives? And why do you not address that question? Because if I were in some kind of work relationship with a power more powerful than myself, I'd want to call them to task at every turn because of the disparity of the power relationship.
I'm not sure I understand the reference to the Crimea.
It's just that whole region has been sought. It's not a new thing. It's just appeared in our press or our consciousness as though it's had no past.
I'm just saying that there is a historical connection here. It is not just emerging because of Afghanistan, which would be enough. But what I'm saying, because of the long-standing interest, the 100-year preparation for attachment to that area, using the Rothschilds and Azerbaijan as one example, they were there 100 years or more ago, and they withdrew because they felt the timing wasn't right. So there's a timing question of when you enter a region in the world. So what I'm saying to you is, how do you know this human rights plank put forward by the United States isn't appropriated and put to the service of other objectives?
Why don't I start and then you can contribute? The tension or the problem that you just identified is one that we're very much aware of and one I started to address earlier. We are very concerned that the human rights plank is appropriated, as you put it, or subverted for other interests, be they strategic or be they economic. For the U.S. in the past few years, we've largely seen a greater strategic interest, more than an economic interest in Afghanistan, in Uzbekistan. With the EU, however, I think there is a mix of interests. And Germany, as Umida said, has become a very important target of our advocacy on Uzbekistan because they have economic interests as well as strategic interests. And we have seen them time and time again put human rights second to those interests, and it's something that is a constant subject of our work.
Вопрос о том, почему мы не обеспокоены о том, как Соединенные Штаты в данном случае используют как называемые права человека для стратегических или экономических интересов.
Да,
I'm going to translate for Omida so she can be very precise in her answer.
Мы бы очень хотели, чтобы сильные государства были заинтересованы только в том, чтобы улучшить ситуацию с правами человека. Но реальность такова, что каждое государство имеет свои геополитические интересы, и нам, как правозащитникам, приходится считаться с этой реальностью и работать с тем, что есть.
We would be very happy if strong governments only were interested in the improvement of the human rights situation in Uzbekistan, but we recognize that governments have a multiplicity of interests in the region, and as human rights defenders, we're forced to deal with the situation that exists rather than the ideal.
Поэтому наша задача состоит в том, чтобы максимально извлечь пользу для улучшения прав человека с такими сильными державами в отношениях Узбекистан с Европейским Союзом или с американцами.
So our task as human rights defenders is to bring the maximum benefits to the human rights situation that we can.
Что ты говорила? С отношениями с Америкой и Европейским Союзом.
With relationships with the United States and with the European Union.
И люди в Узбекистане, они ненавидят это правительство, и они хотят свободы. Поэтому мы говорим этим государствам о том, что когда они хотят улучшения с режимом, с президентами, с президентом Узбекистана, его власть держится только на силе.
People in Uzbekistan hate the current regime. They hate President Karimov. And so when we engage with partner governments, the EU or the US, we tell them that in their dealings with Uzbekistan, that the regime is really only propped up by violence.
И если они хотят поддерживать страну, они хотят поддерживать народ Узбекистана, то они должны поддерживать права человека.
And if they want to support the country, if they want to support the people of Uzbekistan, then they must support human rights.
Thank you. I have another sort of follow-up question on that, Alison and Yumida. When you look at partner governments such as the EU and Germany specifically, what areas are you looking to have the most success in getting Germany to perhaps apply more leverage on the Uzbek government in relationship to human rights?
В каких конкретных областях?
Ну, очень много возможностей. Например, Европейский Союз и американцы могут поднимать вопросы проблемы Узбекистана на международном уровне. Это как ООН и другие. Они должны требовать, чтобы Узбекистан пригласил специальных репортеров в страну, чтобы он открыл международные офисы.
There are lots of different areas. There are lots of different potentials for engagement and for raising the situation. We would like to see the EU and the US and Germany raise the human rights situation in Uzbekistan at different international levels and in different international institutions, like the UN. We'd like to see them demand that the Uzbek government invite international experts from the UN, like the special rapporteurs on torture and human rights defenders, to Uzbekistan. What else did you say?
Конституция Узбекистана, в отличие от Бирмана, говорит, что это правовая страна, это где разрешена свобода слова. И я думаю, каждый раз, когда государство, когда чиновники встречаются с правительством, они должны напоминать о том, что они не требуют чего-то особенного, а требуют соблюдения своих законов и конституции.
Perhaps in contrast to Burma, Uzbekistan, the Uzbek constitution is based on the rule of law and talks about Uzbekistan being a law-based country with a law-based democratic country. So we demand or we ask that governments, when they meet with Uzbekistan, demand not something special, not something extraordinary, but only that they fulfill their own laws.
Перед собой и народом, и у нас просто нет возможности достучаться до него. И единственное, что мы используем контакты, когда иностранные делегации встречаются с президентом, мы просим их донести до него ситуацию.
The president of Uzbekistan has really built a wall between himself and the people so that it's very difficult for us to have access to him. We can't knock through the wall. And so our best form of access is by talking with Uzbekistan's partner governments and asking that they bring concerns to the president.
Мы говорим о том, чтобы они поднимали вопросы прав человека, и это очень нервирует президента, и я думаю, что это им будет, что это полезно.
So whenever there are official visits to Uzbekistan, be they cultural delegations or economic delegations, we raise human rights issues and ask that those delegations raise human rights issues in their official meetings. And this really impacts the president, makes him very uncomfortable, makes him very nervous, and we think that it is a very useful strategy.
Thank you. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Meet the Human Rights Activist Boji of Burma and Yumida Niyazova of Uzbekistan.
Just to add on that, in the Burma context, and tell people that we've been having a very eerie couple of weeks when we do public talks, that the amount of similarities between Uzbekistan and Burma are depressing, but there are quite a lot. And the new constitution that was voted on in May this year actually does have international standards of basic rights with language that is almost word for word from the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. But the Constitution just has all these broad caveats all the way through it, where you have this great kind of language that sounds very good, and right at the end it has a line that says, unless it is against state security, which, you know, is incredibly broad. And then there's all these civil criminal laws that we're now seeing everyone being sentenced under inside Burma that they catch people on. So the Constitution says everyone's free to do what they want and be part of a great society unless you threaten the reigning order. And so there is a lot of similarities that dictators often use the rule of law and often use the language of human rights and representative democracy and pervert it in such a way. And it's amazing how often the international community is fooled by such behavior.
Thank you. Thank you all for your great work, and thank you for touching on that topic, because it was it leads right into my question. In fact, you partially answered the question. I wanted to hear from Boji on how he on his take on this. We know, as you touched on, that the Bush administration has an ideologically sound approach to Burma. Unfortunately, that's in the form of sanctions. It's not working at all as long as trade goes on with China and India, Russia. There are other approaches that we're seeing now, organizations like the Global Justice Center in New York, using the courts potentially. And very specifically, as you just touched on, David, there are laws on the books in Burma that can be of use to at least try and embarrass the junta, perhaps. Very specifically, when Aung San Suu Kyi's current term of house arrest was extended, some lawyers pointed out that this was in direct violation of Burma's own laws. And as far as I know, there was no response to that. But I was wondering if you could comment in general about that sort of a strategy using the courts and the rule of law.
Yeah. Also, we really supported sanction. Now, the United States imposed targeted sanction and financial transaction. That is really useful. And then there is really great pressure to its business cycle. And then also, like the Amani soldiers, some soldiers, they dislike also their leaders. So we have to make a problem between them. Also, there is one thing targeted sanction can help. That is one thing. Another thing is, in Burma, all are controlled by the military regime, administration, judiciary, legislative. So it's me, the judge. Everyone can be the judge. If he or she can read your paper, if he or she can open an envelope, and then it's okay, you can be everyone can be the judge. So therefore, very recently, lawyers were arrested. So lawyers said to the judge, so according to, as of his client stopped lawyer to say something for them, because client doesn't trust to the court. Client doesn't cooperate with the judge. Also, lawyer said to the judge like this, as of his clients, that was contempt to the court, and then was given 6 months imprisonment. You know, it means we cannot work within the rule of law, because in Burma there is no rule of law. Anyone can be arrested anytime. Also, even there is a ILO, International Labour Organization office, liaison office in Burma. Military region also tell the people, you can complain if you dissatisfied, but if you complain, you will be arrested under the accusation of leaking the important information to others. So that is generally in Burma, it's me. So there is no rule of law means you can be killed, you can be arrested at any time.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question.
Yes, my question is to Ms. Umida from Uzbekistan. And I would like to ask her, how would you compare the situation in Uzbekistan with respect to Kazakhstan, with respect to Kyrgyzstan, and with respect to Tajikistan?
Compare with these three republics, the situation in Uzbekistan worse. Because this oddest country, they don't imprison human rights defenders. They allow some freedom of press. There are a few independent mass media in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan and even in Tajikistan. And compared with this country, only Uzbekistan has in Uzbekistan about four. Not about four journalists who imprisoned, and in other countries there was no journalist who imprisoned.
Thank you. Our thanks to Boji, co-founder of the Assistance Association of Political Prisoners, and Umida Niyazova, journalist, and Dave Matheson and Allison Gill of Human Rights Watch for their comments today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.